Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality and beyond. We are the podcast of hope. I'm Rory Hearn, your host, and joined as always by my co-host and alter ego, Tony Groves. Tony, how are you?
Not so hopeful at the moment, actually.
Not so hopeful, I know. These are dark times, indeed they are, across the waters. We are joined by the wonderful, as always, and wicked John Harris from The Guardian. John, how are you?
Alright, I'm surviving. Still upright.
Still upright. Still upright. Listen, you wrote a very interesting article there just on the weekend around two things I thought was quite interesting about potentials for hope and Labour and what they did and they didn't do. But firstly, kind of straight out, what are your kind of three things do you think that Labour lost this election or the Tories won it for the Tories?
Wow, what a question.
You're well able for it, John. Well able.
The Tories won the election for many, many reasons, right? But the most immediate and most vivid among them was the fact that most people were very, certainly in England and Wales, were very weary of Brexit, are very weary of Brexit. They've seen politics go round and round in circles and not really get anywhere. And Johnson very cleverly capitalised on that weariness and exasperation with that slogan, get Brexit done, right? Now, you can have an argument about whether that's a sort of one big lie in the sense that the process of Brexit has only just started, but it contained within it this idea that all of that rigmarole around withdrawal, you know, endless parliamentary defeats and John Bercow yelling about this and that, that was all going to get done to one side. And just in time for Christmas, the chaos would subside. And he had a very ready audience for that. So that's one reason, right? Mm. The other reason was lots and lots of people who maybe traditionally have voted Labour and certainly live in traditionally Labour voting areas were just not impressed with Jeremy Corbyn or the Labour Party's offer at this election and what the Labour Party had come to represent. Mm. Now, that's very, very deep-seated. It wasn't helped by the fact that the Labour Party initially promised a sort of straightforward, quite effective pitch, you know, about the mess British society was in. The mess the economy was in, rising inequality and poverty and all that, and it got lost because every day was a different promise. You know, free broadband, nationalise the water, cut your rail fares by a third, and the Labour Party ended up saying it was going to make everybody £6,700 a year better off, and you were thinking, well, how do you know? What is this? It got too much, right? And any sort of clarity was lost in the midst of all that. That's sort of reason two. Reason three is that politics has been, and certainly Labour's politics and the left's politics, has been sort of falling out of kilter with a lot of places considered to be its traditional heartlands for years and years and years. You know, the peak of the vote share for the Labour Party in the post-industrial areas of England and Wales, let alone Scotland, where the game's over. I mean, the Labour Party's pretty much extinct in Scotland. But, you know, the vote share in 97 in a lot of those places was like 70, 75%. And the next time it was 60. And the time after that it was 55. And then you end with this slightly surreal spectacle of former coal fields and steel towns all returning Conservative MPs.
Yeah.
But that's where we are. It has a sort of mind-boggling aspect, but as soon as you start to think about it, it doesn't seem that surprising.
But John, in terms of the strategy of Labour, that, you know, on the one hand, there was no way to win the election in a sense because being split either between Leave or Remain meant that it was always not going to be either. And in this election that Johnson successfully made it about Brexit, that essentially they were always going to lose it in that way.
But not lose it this heavily. And also the other thing is, this is a pretty awful government, right? In terms of the quality of its personnel, it reminds me of the absolute, I'm old enough to say this, the fag end of the John Major period. It might even be worse than that, you know, like the William Hague period when the Tories were in opposition and Tony Blair famously looked at him and said, weird, 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 you know. This is not top quality personnel. They have a terrible record. I mean, when we were out on the road talking to people, as we do all the time, even the people who had decided or were deciding to vote Conservative talked about the idea that society couldn't go on like this, that the cuts had gone too far. talked about the housing crisis, about insecure employment. You know, in the 80s, you sensed that half the population wanted Mrs. Thatcher's vision. I didn't sense that at all here. You know, most of the working class people I spoke to who were voting Conservative were doing it reluctantly and knowing that doing so was hardly ideal. So, in that sense, I don't quite buy the idea that this election was always going to be lost. You know, but it needed leadership. The Labour Party didn't talk about Brexit for 3 years, don't forget.
Mm.
It barely mentioned it. I've lost count of the number of times I've watched Jeremy Corbyn speak and not mention Brexit at all, when that was all that was in the political foreground. And then they suddenly dropped this somewhat complicated policy on people.
Yeah.
At the end. That was always going to leave people cold. I don't think it's that simple, really. I think there is some truth to the idea that in a different universe, Johnson was beatable.
Oh, he was. He was definitely beatable. He was beatable on his own record. But if you come out with a manifesto that, as you said, seemed to have a new promise every 15 minutes, and then you have a position on Brexit, which was ultimately the key issue people were just had Brexit fatigue, and Johnson kept it simple, and Corbyn came out with, oh, we'll do this, we'll negotiate this deal, then we'll come back and we'll give you another vote, and people
exactly,
said,
exactly.
Leave us alone, you know, we just want to actually get on with it.
Exactly. I'm very ambivalent about Brexit in all sorts of ways, and ideally I would have liked another referendum and all the rest of it, but once I sort of got out there again, it was instantly revealed to me that the idea of a second referendum was a complete non-starter because people were so tired.
Yeah.
And everybody knew as well that a second referendum is a poisonous political prospect, best avoided. And that's probably correct. I say that with massive reluctance. I don't want Britain to leave the EU, but I think that's where we've ended up.
But can I ask, though, the looking forward now, so the Boris Johnson has gotten himself this huge majority. He can then, we kind of hope, best case scenario, maybe move for a softer Brexit, you know, which won't play well with his ERG, but he doesn't have to placate them anymore. He won't have to, he's already, you know, the DUP can literally get in the Irish Sea. You know, these are the big changes. Is that your feeling?
Don't know, really. Who knows? Because, I mean, already there's talk today that they're going to put in legislation the idea that Brexit has to be accomplished by the end of next year, which, as you probably know, threatens a hard Brexit.
Yeah, yeah.
Threatens a no-deal Brexit, and I know that the city is already getting very jittery about that, and the markets and stuff, so that seems to be a real prospect. I think, you know, as in all of these things, one can make sort of comforting assumptions about the way it's going to go, but I don't necessarily think they're going to turn out to be true. But, I mean, having said that, you know, I don't want a Johnson government, but there is an idea around that they are aware that somehow all of these new votes in post-industrial places somehow have to be rewarded and reflected in policy. A Johnson is not quite a Thatcherite. Nobody knows what he is.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, I was thinking of that, John, in the sense of how, beyond Brexit, how the politics was played. Like, was this... You know, we saw Johnson shifted to talk about, you know, he was going to put, you know, defending the NHS and, you know, all this completely against, you know, what politics the Conservatives have put in place. But is there a sense that there will be, like, that they saw that there was huge anger out there over austerity, or do you think they will hammer on with austerity and neoliberalism?
Oh, I think, well, you can take neoliberalism as a given.
Yeah. There'll be no shift there.
No, but I think sort of within that, I think there will be appreciably different aspects of certain bits of policy. I think they probably will spend a fair amount of money on infrastructure in the north. You know, they're not stupid.
Mm.
They, you know, these, if they're going to keep the loyalty of these places, there has to be some measure of change there. Now, the danger with that is you sort of get back into a scenario not unlike New Labour, where, you know, there's nice roads and perhaps nice new trains and that, and so on, and they're good things. But the essential realities of insecure employment, widening inequality, you know, the fact that people are very vulnerable to poverty and all that, those things will still be there. I mean, if you travel around, it's a good example of this, if you travel around, you don't need me to tell you that one of the key things that sort of defines the atmosphere in a lot of places in England, Wales and Scotland, is the benefit system and how sort of cruel and punitive it's become. And everywhere you go, you meet somebody who's had to go to a food bank because they've been sanctioned or, you know, even if their benefits are coming through, they can't afford to eat. I don't think any of that's going to change. It's a mixed picture. But Johnson, the only thing Boris Johnson's interested in really is himself and his political, and the idea that he can kind of politically prosper. And the way to do that is not to carry on turning the screw. So in that sense, I think some elements of policy will have to change, and there are signs that they are. But I don't think that will deliver anything like the sort of fundamental change in the economic and social model that Britain needs.
Which leads me on to the alternative, and obviously now with Corbyn basically having to eventually reluctantly give up the leadership, the likelihood of the next Labour Party, do you see them moving slightly more away from his? Because I mean, some of this idea of that, you know, that they need to move more closer to the middle, that's not necessarily going to represent what their membership is.
Yeah, I think, I think the middle's a red herring. In the sense that the chief thing wrong with Labour politics, and this applied particularly to Corbyn, but it applied to New Labour and what came before that as well, is just the sense that the sort of old Labour statist view of everything has never really gone away. The Labour Party still has this idea that it has a monopoly of wisdom, that you vote Labour and their people then take over in Westminster and Whitehall and pull these big rusty levers and everything then is okay, right? And it's reflected in the sort of hierarchical top-down structures of the trade unions, of the Labour Party itself, right? Every time you go to a left-wing meeting in this country, it's always the same. There's four chairs at the front. Everyone has to sit there and listen to people drone on. And then somebody says, oh, I think we've got about 5 minutes for questions. I mean, that takes you right to the heart of what's wrong with the left in Britain and elsewhere, right?
Not very different here, John. Not very different here.
I'm sure it isn't. And somewhat counterintuitively, I have a lot of hope. Having been on the road again, I mean, it's not like I haven't been on the road. I've been on the road for 10 years, really. But having been on the road for 6 weeks again, we made a point this time of going to find initiatives and projects and self-help organisations who sort of live out their socialism as a matter of everyday experience. And what they're doing is amazing. But 9 times out of 10, it has nothing to do with the state or with party politics. And interestingly, when we asked people who volunteered and worked in a lot of these projects what they thought of the election, a lot of them were indifferent, right? Now, there's the issue. You know, I think the Labour Party has to sort of reinvent, or the left has to reinvent itself from the grassroots. And it won't look like this sort of monolithic statist, where you want to nationalise everything type Labour Party that you ended up with this time. But it won't be, you know, like back to the middle ground.
It won't.
You know, or obsessing about focus groups or any of that. That's not the sort of Labour Party I want. Throughout this last 3 years, one of the most frustrating things was that if you criticised or expressed scepticism about Corbynism or what was going on in the Labour Party, you were called a centrist dad and a Blairite and all this, right? There was a position, which I think you'll see in this leadership contest, actually, which was very different from that, which was a left critique of Corbynism. And that's where I've always been, you know. I just don't like, I think statism is something that belongs to the 20th century. 1945 was a long time ago. It doesn't mean I don't believe in equality and a public realm as separate from the market, right? And all of the tenets of, enduring tenets of left-wing thinking, I just want a radically different way of delivering them, which is suitable for the age in which we live. And Corbynism didn't get near that, unfortunately.
It's a really interesting, I was struck by that in your article, John, the idea, you know, of kind of this kind of change happening through like cooperatives and social enterprise that are addressing housing or community support or, you know, healthcare on the ground, that this kind of, which is, kind of, exists, is quite strong here in Ireland, but I know it's strong in the UK as well. That how much is this something that's just marginal, or how much do you think, no, this is a movement that is growing or has potential to really, you know, shift our economic model? Because there's a lot of approaches, as you well know and we know, in terms of how do we achieve, you know, a radical change towards a socially just, environmentally sustainable society. And, you know, a lot of people would articulate this idea that the change comes from within rather than this idea of, you know, you take over the state, as you're talking about, and you change it from the top, that from the bottom, and that grassroots needs to kind of be nurtured and supporting. But where do you kind of sense, having been out there, where that's at?
Well, nobody's tried yet to sort of, I don't know what the word is really, to sort of begin to sort of have a conversation about what all these things have in common.
Mm.
and how some of the energy that's definitely there in these projects might sort of be carried over into the political system. You have to be very, very careful here. It's not like I'm suggesting the Labour Party should come along and say, oh, well, we'll have this, you know, come and everyone working on this social project, come and join the Labour Party.
Yeah.
It's different, but I think there's a lot to be learned from these projects and these initiatives and all this work about what change looks like.
Mm.
And it leads you into a lot of conclusions that are about dispersing power, right? About the fact that local government in England and Scotland and Wales is far too marginal and peripheral. And even in its own way, it's sort of centralised itself, you know. It's not very good at pushing power down to the community level. And you can envisage what that might look like. I mean, you see sort of flashes of it in the coastal city of Plymouth in the southwest of England. There's a very innovative Labour council, which has gone out of its way to foster cooperatives and lots of social enterprise. And the Labour Party in Plymouth sort of sits within that, and that's one of the reasons why, even though Plymouth voted 60% for Brexit, the one Labour MP down there was returned, right? Now, that's interesting. So it's about power, it's about the state, it's about not denying that there are things that the central state has to do, like taxation, right? And about a sort of fiscal framework, and about setting targets for climate change, and ensuring that they're met, and all the rest of it. But the one thing wrong, this central part of the English or British condition, which played its part in Brexit, is that people feel powerlessness, right? People, and if people feel powerless, what do you have to give them? Power.
Mm.
I always struggle with that, because in tech speak and management speak, they always say, oh, empower your people, and then they'll say to you, but empowerment comes from within. So it's always this
empower them with the illusion of power.
Yeah, I don't let them get too much of it. But I think there is, like, we're obviously, this changes things for Ireland as in the dynamic, you know. This gives us the opportunity to look at inevitably, you know, we've seen what the seismic changes here, where we now have more nationalists in the seats than we have of unionist seats. It's the sort of changes I didn't think I would see in my lifetime, and yet the changes are actually the pace of them are now picking up. You know, I suppose. Well, I would, you know, is there talk of, as we're starting to talk about in Ireland, about, well, actually, maybe the driving change for this, as we've actually seen here in terms of what's just happened in by-elections and in our local elections, is talk around the Green New Deal and you know, are Labour or someone else, are they grasping that?
Yeah, fairness to the Labour Party, one of the better bits of their campaign this time was the fact that the Green New Deal and the idea of some sort of decisive step ahead on climate change is pretty central to it. That wasn't bad, you know.
Mm.
Within all that, actually, though, within the sort of new green politics, again, you know, it pushes you beyond this idea of sort of monoliths and centralist everything, because even the way that power generation is moving is increasingly devolved and localised, right? Increasing amounts of power is generated not by huge, hulking great power stations, right, but by things that are much more tangible and sort of visible to people. And you've got things like a thriving movement of energy cooperatives. I'm sure you have these in Ireland as well, right?
Not enough.
It's a thriving movement.
Not enough.
They're there.
What's the politics of all that? That, again, gets you into this other question. I think people have this idea about climate action that, again, it's something that has to be supervised by the central state. In this very, as the French would say, sort of dirigiste way, ordering everyone to stop doing this and stop doing that. Now, there's some truth in that. But if it's going to mean anything, it has to happen in the context of empowering places. So I think that's another part of the conversation. I don't know whether the left is going to get there this time yet. The other thing is the left's got to be very much more pluralistic.
Mm.
The idea that the Labour Party is the sort of be-all and end-all just doesn't add up. And one of the most overlooked things, actually, about this result in the UK is that the Green Party's vote went up very sizably. A lot of people voted Green. It's just that our electoral system means they don't get any seats, or one, or whatever, you know, that's all they've got. But that's part of the conversation as well. If the left's going to rejuvenate itself, it's got to look way outside its current boundaries. You know, some of the answers are in there, but not all of them, I suppose.
And I think there's a lot of truth in that, and it's something that we've been talking about a lot here in terms of the Irish left and the need to embrace different, you know, different perspectives, and the need for the left to move away from dogmatic, you know, positions and to embrace itself, you know, of the lots of diverse groups in society, but the diverse approaches to change as well. But putting that aside, like, I couldn't help but be struck by looking, to reduce it to its most superficial level, Johnson was an effective performer and an effective entertainer, just like Trump. And has politics, as we understood how you fight election campaigns, is it fundamentally changed, and that now we are reduced to a politics of the spectacle? And if the left is actually to compete, it has to produce its own politics of a spectacle. But it can be different. And if we look at Sanders, if we look at Sanders, for example, and I can't remember who, it might have been your article or someone else's article in The Guardian said that, you know, the problem, I was with another analysis I saw, that the problem with Corbyn was he was too nice. He wasn't angry. He needed to express that anger that people felt. And that the problem was that he didn't express himself. And people need the expression because people are so beaten down. And if the left doesn't express itself in that way, not in the way that Johnson does it, but in a way that captures people in his imagination, it's never going to compete in the current era.
You have to be very careful with this, in the sense that, as I said earlier, I didn't meet many people who were voting for Boris Johnson and the Conservatives with much enthusiasm, right? It's not like England has just risen up and said, we love Boris, isn't he great, right? I think that's the way it differs from Trump to a large extent, because when I went following Trump around the campaign trail in 2016, you know, I went to rallies that had 10,000 people in them in small dusty towns in Indiana and stuff.
Yeah.
There was sort of Trump mania, right? That didn't happen here. I think the factors behind this are much more complicated and nuanced. So I don't quite buy that. Having said that, I think there are dangers in the way that Johnson run and what that might say about modern politics, in the sense that he evaded scrutiny completely. Mm. I mean, for a lot of the campaign, it seemed like he was barely there. Also, the Conservative Party told a lot of lies, outright lies, in the course of this campaign and seemed to get away with it. But there are uncomfortable things for the left in all this. I mean, it's not like saying you're going to be £6,700 a year better off is a hard and fast truth, because it isn't, right?
Mm.
Or when Corbyn stood there and said, we will end child poverty. Really? How are you going to do that? You know, some of their overinflated promises definitely sort of fell the wrong way of a truth-falsity sort of axis. So I think there are real dangers in this, and I think in the end, getting involved in sort of spectacular, strongman, angry, macho politics is not the way. What the left has to do, among many other things, is it has to go back to, I've probably mentioned Antonio Gramsci on your programme a thousand times.
Yeah,
right?
We can't go an episode without mentioning him, John.
But the notion of hegemony is absolutely central to any political strategy for the left, right? How do you put down roots? How do you begin to change the nature of common sense, you know? How do you make yourself visible in people's lives to the point then that voting for you feels like a natural expression of what's been going on anyway, right? And Corbynism didn't do that. It dropped this great big policy program on people like it was from another planet. It did very little groundwork on it at all. Apart from nationalising the railways, maybe, which had got into the culture, that's what needs to happen. And that's why I come back to this idea of civil society beyond the big state. Because it's only in people's everyday lives that your politics can take root successfully. And that's another reason why this idea of concentrating on people and place is so important. I'm not making many jokes today. I feel like...
No, we're getting pretty dark and deep, but I do think that...
I feel hopeful about all this. That's the point.
Yeah, no, I see.
It's not like the sort of potential or the beginnings of this aren't out there. They really, really are. When I stand outside Hibernian FC with this amazing working class self-help organisation called Helping Hands in Edinburgh, right, and I watch droves of people pull up in their cars, right, and in the course of the day they collected 40 tons of food.
Really?
Now, of course, what sits under that is the fact that lots and lots of people are hungry, right? But look at that capacity. It's amazing. Look at what you can do.
Do you think that there'll be large, you know, in terms of, we've seen it against Tories and the Conservative governments in the past, like protests against, you know, Johnson, in terms of, you know, civil society mobilising in any sense against austerity, housing?
Well, it'd be nice, but again, you know, it only gets you so far. I mean, we had a protest march a week in this country for the last 3 years.
Yeah.
With everyone with their ironic placards saying, oh, you know, what about my dog, or let's go and have a cup of tea, you know, all that stuff.
Mm. And don't make me, what was it, born British, don't make me die Irish? That one went down like a ton of bricks over here anyway.
I'm so angry I didn't know what to write on this placard.
Yeah.
You're killing me, you guys. Just became part of the sort of routine spectacle of politics. It certainly didn't advance the case against Brexit at all. And I went on some of those marches as a punter, not as a journalist. In the end, I think it probably served to sort of harden the divide in the country, you know. So I don't really know about that. I think a lot of energy is probably better expended where people live on beginning to create these sort of signs or symbols of how to live in a different way and how to express your sort of compassionate, solidaristic side, you know, how to develop that side of life. Because as I said, in the end, that's where an alternative politics for all this will come from. The problem with going on a march is, as Pablo Iglesias, the Podemos fellow in Spain, said, what happens when everyone goes? And the problem is, for the last 3 years, everyone went home.
Yeah. I think, from an Irish perspective, we need to understand that. Yeah, it's about building that solidarity, and also actually saying, well, this might be, when you look at what happened in the UK, it's not the end. It might be just the end of the beginning.
I think as well. Yeah, that there's huge lessons for us here in Ireland in terms of, you know, looking at this politics and, you know, everything you've talked about the left there and how Labour responded. There's a lot of lessons for people engaged in civil society here, and, you know, that those ideas of pluralism, of going back to, you know, being with the grassroots and where change comes from. And also, I think, presenting policies in a straightforward way and not, you know, trying to overpromise as well, but actually presenting coherent alternatives. And there is, you know, that idea, I think, you know, you presented hope, but I wonder as well, as Brexit unfolds, going to be, you know, it won't be what Johnson actually promised, and he could crumble under the weight of his own promises as well.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, everyone has to be careful with this in the sense that, I, you know, it's not like I'm willing the country to go down the toilet and everything to go wrong. I mean, it just strikes me that Brexit is inevitable now. We're going to have to make the best of it. And the left will have no influence on that at all. I mean, that's down to Boris Johnson and his people, and I don't feel wholly convinced by it. And it might be the case that it may go sufficiently wrong that it might push a few more voters back towards the left. But I think that's not, I don't think that can play any role in any conversation about what to do next.
Yeah.
Because the danger is then you just think, well, we'll just sit and wait. You know, the left always, you know, too often the left sits there and says, oh, we'll just wait for the inevitable collapse of capitalism. Yeah. And it never seems to happen. So I don't think that's the point. You know, the point is, get off Twitter. Stop arguing with people on Twitter all day. You know, there's a lot of this goes on, you know.
Mm.
And, you know, there are loads of examples to learn from, some of which are within the Labour Party itself. You know, on election day, I went out in the new town of Milton Keynes in the most awful weather you've ever seen, with lots and lots of people in their 20s involved in Momentum who'd come up from London and were tirelessly working for the Labour Party. And they were lovely people. They weren't sectarian at all. They understood all the deep tensions and contradictions in the Labour Party's position. They're still members of the Labour Party, you know, and they're the future, necessarily so. You know, as I keep saying, the picture isn't quite as bleak as it looks, but it's the point is you have to start with the right conclusions, and so far, maybe not enough of those are being drawn.
Listen, John, thanks so much for joining us. Brilliant analysis, as always.
Well, I still get out of bed in the morning. Yeah. So as I said, I've come out of this election campaign feeling a bit more hopeful, and I thought, I would, the same as when I came to Ireland and met you the first time, Rory, and did all that work about housing. All the activists I met who were involved in that, and again, a lot of that was very unorthodox, it was outside the traditional structures of politics, but it was being very effective in the sense that housing was coming onto the political agenda, the government was clearly on the run, you know. It's not like this kind of grassroots activist-based politics doesn't work. When you see it work, you know, we just need lots more of it.
Absolutely, yeah, no, I think that's it's a great point, and it's a great message for our listeners as well in terms of the different possibilities of change and hope.
Can we say Happy Christmas to our listeners?
We can, of course. Happy Christmas.
Listen, folks, we do appreciate your support this year. This is our 52nd episode, so that's one a week. For a fellow who said, you know, we'll do 10 of them, Tony.
52nd, this year. Oh, this year. Oh, jeepers.
So, yeah, no, listen, John, great to talk to you again, mate. We do appreciate the support. We appreciate getting to talk to great people like yourselves. We do need people to come on board and give us a price for a cup of coffee. Head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Thank you.
And we promise that if we give us enough money, we'll fly John over here and we'll do a special live reboot with John. Live.
And I might never come home.
Exactly.
Thanks, folks.
Thanks, John.